Welcome back to the Board of Forestry virtual meeting room. A reminder for members of the public that if you would like to submit written testimony for information and decision items presented at this meeting, to send in your comments by June 23rd so they can be included with the meeting record. Our next topic is Senate Bill 1602 implementation update. And Mr. Barnard, you're going to lead off, if I'm correct.
Good afternoon, Chair Kelly, members of the board, and State Forester Hirsch. My name is Josh Bernard, and I'm serving as the project lead for the department's implementation of Senate Bill 1602. For today's update, I've asked several of the project team members to join me virtually. I'm going to kick it off and then turn it over to staff to cover the new requirements of Senate Bill 1602, e-notification development, interagency coordination, and training and outreach. At the end, I'll be happy to answer questions. In February 2020, forest industry and environmental interest representatives announced an agreement through a memorandum of understanding. In June 2020, the Oregon legislature held a special session. During that session, the memorandum was put into law via Senate Bill 1602. It passed both chambers with broad support. The governor signed the bill into law on July 7, 2020. So the bill contained about 8 pages of new statutory text. It did not strike out any previous statutes or rules, meaning that all the requirements are in addition to the current Forest Practices Act. The law is very prescriptive for a statute. For example, it sets requirements such as notifying by 7 p.m. for helicopter spray operations planned for the next day. Here's an overview of what the Senate Bill 1602 does. The law increases helicopter spray buffers around homes, schools, water intakes, and some streams for helicopter spraying pesticides. It expanded salmon, steelhead, and bull trout rules in the Siskiyou region, and it establishes helicopter pesticide spray communication requirements. It establishes new interagency coordination with Water Resources Department, and it sets forth mediated discussions facilitated by the governor's office for improving the Forest Practices Act. Some of these requirements are already in place, and some will be in place in the near future. When Senate Bill 1602 became law, it was not on the department's work plan. To meet the workload and short timelines required by 1602, the agency assigned a project team to focus on this work and meet the needs of this change in core business. The project team includes Salem and field staff. Many of the team members, including myself, have stepped out of their normal roles to focus on implementing Senate Bill 1602. As I noted in my introduction, I'm serving as the project leader. We have Nick Hinneman in public affairs, helping with communications. Joe Touchstone, who is serving as project manager and business analyst. Michael Lathrop, who is providing tech support. Paul Clements, who is covering training and outreach. Brooke Burgess is the lead on interagency coordination and will also be reviewing information submitted by individuals interested in registering for helicopter pesticide spray communications. Jay Walters on the policy and implementation front and field staff from each of the areas in Oregon. Jana Peterson, stewardship forester from Eastern Oregon area. Ed Walmart, unit forester in Northwest Oregon area. And Jennifer Ward, stewardship forester in Southern Oregon area. The current focus of the team is on the e-notification development. The project team meets weekly with the vendor to ensure the system meets the law's requirements. The team clarifies needs and changes by the end of the week, and the vendor presents any revised prototypes the next week. The vendor gives the project team a test version once a month. This process allows for continuous feedback and fine-tuning and will continue until the project is done. This is a pretty significant lift for the department, and in particular, the project team members. With that note, I want to pause briefly and say thank you to the project team members. Without hesitation, they have dove into this work and are working every day to ensure we have a successful launch of the new requirements. And with that, I will now turn it over to Jay Walters.
Thanks, Josh. Good afternoon, Chair Kelly, members of the board, State Forester Hirsch. I'm Jay Walters, Forest Practices Field Coordinator in the Private Forest Division, now serving on the Senate Bill 1602 implementation team. I'm going to review buffer requirements and a few related provisions of the Senate bill. First, for timber harvest buffers, Senate Bill 1602 extended existing rules for salmon, steelhead, and bull trout, SSBT, streams into the Siskiyou georegion effective January 1st of this year. These rules have been in effect elsewhere in Western Oregon since July of 2017. All the rule language and prescriptions available for the other West Side georegions are now in effect in the Siskiyou georegion. And this is the only part of the Senate bill that calls for rulemaking. As plans presently stand, the department does not plan to enter into rulemaking for any other element of the Senate bill. All right, next slide, please. So next, we're going to watch a video on helicopter spray buffers produced by ODF for training purposes. This has been a really helpful tool for providing a consistent message to landowners, operators, and stewardship foresters across the state on the buffer requirements of the bill.
Hello, I'm Mike Odenthal with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The Oregon Department of Agriculture is responsible for administering the Oregon Pesticide Control Act. This law, along with federal pesticide law, regulates all pesticide use, distribution, and formulation. And remember, pesticides include fungicides, insecticides, rodenticides, herbicides, and antimicrobials. This comprehensive group of laws regulates all pesticide use, including home and garden, farm and forest, and all the other uses. The labels on the pesticide containers explain how to use those products. Remember, the label is the law. People who follow the label instructions are following state and federal laws. The state of Oregon does have additional laws for proper use. The state licenses and offers annual training for professional pesticide applicators and training materials like this video. The goal is to help pesticide users understand the laws so they can use these products safely and responsibly. Pesticides are used every day all around us. People apply pesticide products using spray bottles, backpack sprayers, and sometimes aircraft. Forest managers will sometimes use pesticides to control weeds so their seedlings may flourish and grow into strong, healthy forests. Today, we're discussing rules for helicopter pesticide spray applications. These are typically done in recently harvested areas with newly planted trees. The Oregon Department of Agriculture works with the Oregon Department of Forestry to regulate this pesticide use and to protect our natural resources.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Ward with the Oregon Department of Forestry. My job is to administer Oregon's Forest Practices Act, which is intended to protect natural resources and provide for responsible logging and forest management. The forestry laws require landowners to successfully plant new forests after a harvest. Some landowners use helicopters to apply pesticides to control weeds so the trees can grow. As of January 1st, 2021, the forestry laws include new buffers around schools and streams. These laws apply to helicopter pesticide use, not fertilizer use. Helicopter pesticide applicators must not directly apply herbicides or other pesticides within 300 feet of a school's campus or an inhabited dwelling, like a home. School here means Head Start, private or public school for any K-12 program, college or university, Oregon School for the Deaf, Oregon Youth Authority Residential Academies, and Educational Service Districts. Within the greater of 75 feet, or the full width of the Riparian Management Area, or RMA, of a F or D stream, within 50 feet of a Type N stream where the surface water is present. The spray buffers are horizontal distances. Riparian management areas are measured in slope distances. Bottom line, the buffer distance is whichever is further from the water. Before spraying any pesticides, a notification of operations must be submitted to the Oregon Department of Forestry. The notification must include a map showing water resources. Now, let's take a closer look at each buffer requirement First, let's look at a school adjacent to a newly planted forest. When treating the area, the pilot must leave a 300-foot buffer between the school's campus and the spray area. For inhabited dwellings, like homes, and for qualifying water intake points, the pilot must also leave a 300-foot buffer. Qualifying water intake points are those recorded in the Oregon Department of Forestry's e-notification system. Forestry works closely with the Oregon Water Resources Department and the public to update the qualifying water intake points. Now let's take a look at the other ways the laws protect water quality. These laws require buffers along streams. There are two stream buffer distances. The setback distance from type F or fish bearing and type D or domestic use streams must be the greater distance of either 75 feet or the required vegetated buffer. The required vegetated buffer is sometimes called the riparian management area or RMA. An RMA is an area along streams and other bodies of water where trees and shrubs must be retained and special management practices are required to protect water quality and fish and wildlife habitat. The second stream buffer distance is for type N streams, which do not have fish or domestic use. If surface water is present, pesticides may not be applied within 50 feet of the high water line of the type N stream. The last part of this law addresses interference with and memorializing the work. The law prohibits interference with these pesticide applications. If a person interferes with one of these operations, they can be fined up to $5,000. The law also allows for a person to video or photograph a helicopter application from a place where they have the right to be present, as long as it does not interfere. If you have any questions, please contact your local stewardship forester. Thank you for your interest in the Oregon Forest Practices Act.
Hello, my name is Ted, and I am with the Pesticide Analytical and Response Center. Did you know that no other state coordinates pesticide investigations like Oregon? The Pesticide Analytical and Response Center, or PARC, coordinates pesticide investigations with many different state agencies, including the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and the Oregon Department of Forestry. If citizens have concerns that pesticide use has negatively impacted people, animals, or the environment, they may report these concerns 24 hours a day by dialing 211. Specialists at 211 Info will take your information and forward that information to PARC. And a PARC member agency will follow up with you within one business day. Thank you for your time.
Okay, as the video stated, type N streams, that is streams that are not fish-bearing and do not have domestic use, receive a 50-foot buffer around surface water present at the time of the application. Conversely, type N streams that are dry at the time of the application receive no buffer protection under the Senate bill, but it's important to remember other requirements could come into play as well. Of course, the EPA label is the law, so it's always important to be aware of buffer requirements on the pesticide label. Also, some perennial type N streams require vegetation retention during harvest. This retained vegetation must be protected during helicopter applications of herbicides, even if the type N stream is dry during the application. The Senate bill gave new authority to PARC, the Pesticide Analytical and Response Center. PARC can now accept requests for daily spray records and GPS flight data from healthcare providers, state agencies, and law enforcement. When PARC receives one of these requests, PARC requests the records or data from the applicator, and the applicator must deliver those requested records within certain timeframes. There's a fine for failure to provide the records. It's $1,000 per failed request, and PARC will enforce that requirement. The PARC records request took effect on July 7th of 2020, the day the governor signed the bill. Also, the Senate bill piece forbidding interference with helicopter sprays was mentioned in the video. That also took effect on July 7th, 2020. A local law enforcement, likely a county sheriff, will enforce that piece. And lastly, the Senate bill will be written into statute this coming autumn. Now I'll turn the presentation over to Joe Touchstone.
Thanks, Jay. Good afternoon, Chair Kelly, members of the board, and State Forester Hirsch. I'm Joe Touchstone. I'm the project manager for the Senate Bill 1602 modifications to the e-notification system. Really, there are three major areas in which there are going to be changes to the e-notification system. The first is around the notifier. And Senate Bill 1602 has some pretty unique requirements within it to notify for these helicopter spray operations. Those are the 90-day application windows. Those are updating the activity to be pending by 7 p.m. the day before, and then also reporting whether the operation was complete or incomplete. So those are some of the major things around the notifier. Next, we have the registrant, which is new, and it's unique from the current subscribers that we have today. A registrant will register their qualified water intake or their qualified residence or dwelling. They'll submit information to ODF, and ODF will review that and approve it or request additional information. And then once that is registered, they have a one-mile buffer around their residence or their surface water intake. And then the last area that's different for us is on the ODF side is we are now notifying registrants via text messages. And this is unique, and this is new. And so that's one of the major changes within the system itself. Next slide, please. So the first thing that we've developed and we've tested, and it will be a bit of a change, is the dashboard when you log into your e-notification account. Today, the notifications and subscriptions are there, but then there's a third area under registrations. And if you have an e-notification account, you can do all three of these. You can notify, you can subscribe, and you can register. So all of those will be on the dashboard. Another change that is different from today is the My Helicopter Spray status. So with all of these changes and the requirements around the Senate Bill 1602, we've tried to incorporate some user experience and make it efficient and really kind of easy for notifiers to update their operations. And so putting this on the dashboard, and you can see where it says update my spray status on those two listed underneath those are because they're within that 90-day application window. And that's where the notifier will go in and let any registrants know that there's an operation happening the day before. Next slide. So then this is what that dashboard or what that notification looks like. This is where you will mark it as a pending event that's happening the next day. And then you'll also mark it as you've completed the spray operation. Or if you didn't completely spray a unit, you can mark it as incomplete and then mark it as pending and let registrants know that you're going to spray it again if you need to. And this will be a page that you can easily update all of the units. So we often see these types of notifications have 15, 20 units on them. So you can select all of them or just select a few that you plan on spraying and then mark them as pending, and that will send out any alerts that happen. Next slide, please. This is where the 90-day application window is defined. So within the bill, it states that if there is a registrant within 1 mile, there is a 30-day waiting period before this 90-day application window can occur. If there is not a registrant, then it's a 15-day waiting period. So on this page, we've made it easy to identify, is there a unit with a registrant? And in the middle, in the white, you can see where unit one has a registrant nearby. And so this 90-day window will not begin for at least 30 days from the point of where you are notifying. Next slide, please. We've also tried to make it easier for users to come in and add their chemical information on a single page. So today, activities, this information exists under each unit. Now we've put all of the units on a single page and made it easy to summarize and look at what is being notified, and then put the chemical information and any other details that are relevant to the units very easily across all of the units. Next page. We've also updated site conditions with to incorporate schools and homes. And this is voluntary to let us know this, but it helps the stewardship forester know if you are aware of any schools or school campuses or any homes or dwellings that are within the 300 feet of where you're planning on to apply the pesticides. And then next slide. I'm switching over to the registrant side of things. So if you have a residence or qualifying water intake, you will go to that registration tab from the first page and select you want to register. And so you have the two options, one being a qualifying residence where you will provide us your contact information, which is name, address, and phone number, a physical address that you want to register, or we can also do tax lots if there isn't an actual physical address. So just provide us which county it is in and which tax lots or multiple tax lots you are looking to register. And then you have to provide proof of residency. Do you have rights for that residence? So that's either a lease agreement or driver's license showing that or property tax records. And we've listed all of the documents that you can provide to us. The other side is where you have a qualifying water intake, and to qualify, it has to fit into what we've defined here, being lawns or gardens of a half acre or less, supplying buildings or domestic animals, supplying buildings for people to use or drink, livestock. And then again, you have to provide us the same information, contact information, the GPS coordinates for this. So this is a point, where is the water intake located? And then any documentation we have around permit, certificate, registration, limited license, or order of determination. You can, if you don't have that, and you can actually attest that your water intake qualifies, if you provide us a reason why it is one of these uses, and then you don't have to provide actual documentation there. Next slide, please. And so this is to kind of highlight as we're developing this and going along, one of the requirements of the bill is that we make the notification and the registration process mobile friendly. So working with Timmons, our developer, who is the original developer and continues to help us develop Ferns even to this day, they have, as we've developed all of these new functionalities in here, all of these are being mobile friendly. And, you know, we work with us, as Josh said, we work with them on a weekly basis. Our team meets several times a week to define processes and definitions in here. And then we also have monthly stakeholder meetings that we show interested parties what we've done so far. And they provide feedback to us that allows us to continue our development. So all of these inputs and all of this feedback and all of this development is helping us look forward to a December 15th release of the system. And that will be the phase one part of it. And so now I'm going to hand it over to Brooke Burgess.
Good afternoon, Chair Kelly, members of the board, State Forester Hirsch. I'm Brooke Burgess, and I'll be working directly with getting interested parties registered within the e-notification system to receive these communications. I'll start by expanding on the elements of the bill that cover ODF's enforcement piece for failing to notify and for failing to report in a timely manner and the associated civil penalties. Section 10 of the bill states that if the notifier fails to make the next day announcement or fails to notify the department in a timely manner of a complete or incomplete spray within 24 hours after completion of the spray, they will be subject to a penalty. For the first day, a warning will be issued. For the second day, there's a $1,000 fine. And for the third day on, the penalty is $5,000 a day. Next slide, please. Next, I'll go over the coordination efforts between ODF and the Oregon Water Resources Department to meet the data and the legislative reporting requirements of the bill. The bill requires ODF to record within the e-notification system any points of diversion that are already inventoried by Oregon Water Resources Department and that qualify for a spray buffer. GIS personnel from the Department of Forestry and Water Resources Department have completed working on refining this data set and will be using that for the launch of the new features within the e-notification system. The bill also requires that the Department and Water Resources submit a joint report to the Legislative Assembly during the 2022 session. The report will include the number of points of diversion that have been recorded within the e-notification system, an estimate of how many points of diversion that qualify for a spray buffer remain to be inventoried, and also an estimate of the resources that Water Resources Department would need to identify the points, whether already inventoried or that remain to be inventoried. Monthly meetings with Water Resources Department began in January, and we'll continue to move forward in building our newly formed working relationship. Looking to future meetings, we plan to start discussions on the legislative report and how we plan to share information as we move forward. Now I'll turn the presentation over to Paul Clements.
Good afternoon, Chair Kelly and members of the board and State Forester Hirsch. I'm Paul Clements, and I'm the Training and Compliance Coordinator for the Private Forest Division. I'm here to discuss the efforts to distribute the information about how Senate Bill 1602 will affect forest management practices in Oregon and with respect to the stream classifications and protection standards in the Siskiyou region and aerial applications of pesticide by helicopter. There are a variety of interests who need this information about changes in our process that were brought about by Senate Bill 1602. These included the ODF staff, our external stakeholders, operators, and the e-notification registrants who would receive information about pending operations near them. Let's go to the next slide. The Senate Bill 1602 requires us to engage with other agencies as well. The Oregon Department of Agriculture, the Oregon Water Resources Department, as Brooke noted, and the Pesticide Analytic Response Center and local law enforcement agencies are party to the requirements of the bill in some form or fashion. Now, passage of the bill created a timely need for outreach. New stream classification and protection standards in the Siskiyou for salmon, steelhead, and bull trout streams went into effect on January 1st, as did Type N protection for aerial spraying operations. And when stream classifications are changed, we are required by rule to notify adjacent landowners, and that effort was carried out in the Siskiyou region using postcards and electronic mails based on our notification records. Additionally, we focused trainings prior to the 2021 start, internally and with stakeholders using virtual means, just like we're meeting here today. And the information regarding the new protection standards for Type N streams and distances from dwellings and schools was included in outreach through continuing education programs for pesticide applicators. Next slide, please. Now, looking ahead at this, we know that we're developing a new system. This is not something that we've done before. It's a new business model, and it's going to require new business practices. And we're going to continue to develop our training and outreach materials in a video format as an internet-based program for the next set of new standards that are going to take effect later this year. This outreach effort can be hosted on the agency website in a public-facing fashion, so it can be available in an ongoing manner. And again, This is for, you know, one particular kind of forest operation, a very new set of administrative requirements and on-site practices. And so we're learning as we go, and we appreciate the input and support we've gotten from our coworkers and our stakeholders in moving along as we have. And I appreciate your time, and I'm going to go back now to Josh and let him finish the sound. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for your time this afternoon. You can see there are a lot of moving parts to Senate Bill 1602. And as Joe noted, the system will be fully operational on December 15th, and all the remaining requirements of Senate Bill 1602 will take effect on that date. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Great presentation. Any questions from board members? Carla?
I have two questions. One, at the very beginning, you said that this was negotiated between the forestry interests and the environmental interests. Were there any material deviations in this bill beyond what was negotiated is my first question. My second question, having been on the Ford Family Foundation, one of the things we understand in rural Oregon is how hit and miss our internet systems can be. So if someone in a rural remote area goes onto your system prior to seven the night before and can't get onto this system, what is their backup plan for documenting should your system be down or their internet access be down? What's plan B?
Thank you. So regarding your question around the MOU versus what is currently in the bill today, I haven't done a direct comparison of what the changes were, but what's in Senate Bill 1602 is what's in law for us to implement. So that's what we're working towards. But even if you were just to go back and compare those, there's different terminology that appears in those bills. And I believe there are differences between the two, but the way that we've taken it is Senate Bill 1602 is the piece that we need to implement, but I haven't done a quantitative comparison of the two. So
just for educational purposes, I think it would be beneficial if we just understood what, you know, if there was anything of material difference, it would be helpful for me to have that education.
Okay. Regarding the question around the 7 p.m. notification and what happens if systems go down, the way this is set up is it's all designed to be electronic communications. So somebody will need to be able to make that notice and able to operate the next day. So that does have to come in and hit the ODF system for the parties that might be interested in these communications to receive that information. So that's a requirement. To some extent, that backup systems will be the on the landowner operator to do that. We've heard scenarios described of where they may need to call into a local office to submit that, depending on where they're at, or find a way to submit that. On our end, we're wanting to make sure that the system is robust enough and that they also get a confirmation of receipt, whether that goes to that individual or a designated email box that's for that particular entity. So, yes.
Josh, this is actually a question for State Forester Hirsch. This bill was the result of collaboration and discussions between the timber industry and the environmental community, and resulted in a bill that you're now implementing, which is this is great. And I think that's definitely the way things should transpire here. But my question to you is, given that you have so long in an association with this agency, what role should ODF and the board be playing in these discussions between the timber industry and the environmental community?
Chair Kelly, members of the board, Brenda, it's kind of that could be a pretty broad spectrum question I'm feeling. But I think you're kind of specific to forest practices, if I can. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of my past experience with the agency, my experience or observations were a lot of times the board was really leading and facilitating those conversations. Really, I'd characterize through the board processes and or focused efforts to engage those in very specific engagement processes. I've in the very near term here, I feel like what I've observed or what I've heard relative to the private forest accord is that there's perhaps been somewhat of a pause or relative to maybe those policy discussions. I don't know if that's accurate or not, because I haven't been tracking that as much because of the amount of engagement going on through that process. But I do think that the, you know, basically for the board in terms of the statutory role over all forest policy in Oregon, that this board has a critical role in that.
Thank you. I agree. How do you see us going forward and having that role? I mean, I'm sort of stuck with what next.
In all fairness, Chair Kelly, members of the board, I probably need to think about that a little more. You know, my sense has been in just the brief conversations amongst the executive team would be that, you know, in fact, Kyle Abraham is probably nearby here. You know, I'm going to be catching up more in more detail with him next week. I think to better be able to characterize what I might know through that conversation, it's probably best that I just follow up on that with you. I did want to circle back on the, because I am new into the system here again. Josh, you were speaking to the, you know, obviously the language, the bill that was passed, and that's what we're following. But I kind of missed the language or question maybe that Carla had, where it sounded like there was maybe some negotiation coalition that she was referring to, where there may have been a difference between that conversation and what went into law. And I'm just trying to figure out what that was.
Sure. As I understood, the question is in February 2020, the actual MOU between the conservation and timber interests was drafted, and they had intended for that to go through the short session in February. And since, for a multitude of reasons, that didn't happen, and then the special session was held, and that's when Senate Bill 1602 was put into law. So the question was, as I understood it, was what were the discrepancies between what was in the original MOU signed and Senate Bill 1602 when it was signed into law?
Perfect. Okay. So I think that was a really good question for the board relative to, you know, that adaptation and those interests come from a lot of different places. And so while this is progress and a clear evidence of adaptation, right, to forest practices and or the notification system, these things usually just don't go away. So I think that other, you know, that other backdrop, whatever it was at that point, we can get you that. And looks like Kyle Abraham has joined us. I don't know that I need to put you on the spot, but rather Brenda has invited a question to us for how we might help and work together with the board to perhaps have them leading on that forest policy, forest practices policy front in the future, given perhaps in my own plain language, it's perhaps a little quiet right now, given all that's happening under the private forest accord.
Yeah, Chair Kelly, board members, State Forester Hirsch. So I did hear the question. The agencies, state agencies, ODF, DEQ, ODF&W, and the federal agencies have been part of the private forest accord and working with the negotiating team, both the landowners and the conservation side, on some of the questions that have been raised. And so we have provided input into that process. We've thought a lot about our practices here at ODF and provided input, as well as the other agencies have as well. So we are engaged in a participant role there. And in terms of the board, I don't really know if I can answer that question given the constraints that we have in that process today. But we have been actively engaged.
Thank you. I would just comment through, you know, all of this, that possible accord could be so important and impactful that I think it's appropriate. We've got plenty on our plates to be a little bit patient and also focus not on doing anything that in any way in the short term would endanger the possibility of that accord. And that's just my, you know, personal view of the circumstances and the timeline. And not to take anything away from you know, the importance of our oversight of the Forest Practices Act, or to say that I am you know, comfortable with the status quo. Just I just think that's the right approach for right now for us.
Yeah, I'd agree. If it's not broke, don't fix it. But on the other hand, the board votes on policy. And so I'm just wondering whether they're not to interfere, but at least to be engaged enough to be knowledgeable when things come forward to a vote.
I wasn't making a statement around whether it was fixed or not. That's another discussion. You know, I hear what you're saying. I do believe that we have a potential for a historic accord, and I believe, Kyle, correct me if I'm wrong, that we should really kind of know where we're at by first of next year. Correct?
That's correct, Chair Kelly.
Yeah, Chandra Ferrari, for the record, I think that was what I was going to try to get to, because I agree with both of you in getting the conversation some space. What we want to hear, I think, is that those conversations are productive and they're likely to, you know, lead somewhere. And I know you have confidentiality issues, but to the extent that there are some level of updates that we could get at some point, or have an understanding of the scope of the conversations or something, maybe that's just something to take back to the group. But when there are appropriate intervals to let the board know how it's going. Again, I understand there's a confidentiality issue, but, you know, but I have another question. Is it okay if I...
They all are sworn to silence, and it's been very hard to pierce the wall of silence.
Any side. Appropriately so. I am not trying to pierce anything inappropriately, but to the extent that that is a conversation piece at some point, maybe there are appropriate check-in points around progress and scope at some point.
If I might add, Chair Kelly, board member Ferrari, there was an update yesterday in the legislature around the 1602 process, particularly around the accord. And so if you guys don't have that link, we can certainly share it with you. Both of the parties, I think, spent about 45 minutes to an hour with the legislature on their update. So it could be very timely for this discussion as well.
Thank you. I have one more or two more questions, if that's okay, real quick. Just as it relates to the 1602 group, is that negotiating group, or at least a subset of that group, part of the monthly stakeholder group that you meet with on the implementation efforts?
Great question. To my knowledge, there's no direct representatives. However, there have been connections made for some of the folks that we are working with in our stakeholder group, but not to my knowledge, anyone directly from the private accord mediations.
Okay, but you have representatives on that group from the different stakeholder interests. Is that?
Yep, different stakeholder interests, different companies that have affiliation associated with the accord.
So. Okay. And then just a real quick question to make sure I understood this. As it relates to the qualifying water intakes, Were you saying that you're coordinating with OWRD to get, you know, their most updated list of the, you know, folks who qualify for the definition, and then you're automatically putting them into the system such that they would get the notifications, or do they still need to take the extra step of registering?
Yes, great question. There's two ways information gets into the system. The bill does direct us to work with OWRD to bring any subset of their data. There's qualifiers in the bill for that. And then also somebody can sign up on their own if they come through as a registrant. And there may be duplicative information there, but that's either way. The points can get into the system for protection.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for this presentation.